Chapter 123. Ah, how good it is. It is worth while to leave home for a year, just to enjoy that one draft. Major Dobbin made his appearance the next morning very neatly shaved and dressed, according to his wont. Indeed, it was so early in the morning that nobody was up in the house except that wonderful Boots of Annan, who never seems to want sleep. And the Major could hear the snores of the various inmates of the house roaring through the corridors as he creaked about in those dim passages. Then the sleepless Boots went shirking round from door to door, gathering up at each the Bluchers, Wellingtons, Axonians, which stood outside. Then Joe's native servant arose and began to get ready his master's ponderous dressing apparatus, and prepare his hookah. Then the maidservants got up, and meeting the dark man in the passages, shrieked, and mistook him for the devil. He and Dobbin stumbled over their pails, in the passages as they were scouring the decks of the Royal George. When the first unshorn waiter appeared, and unbarred the door of the inn, the Major thought that the time for departure was arrived, and ordered a post-chaise to be fetched instantly, that they might set off. He then directed his steps to Mr. Sedley's room, and opened the curtains of the great large family bed wherein Mr. Joes was snoring. "Come, up, Sedley," the Major said, "it's time to be off. The chaise will be at the door in half an hour." Joes growled from under the counterpane to know what the time was, but when he at last extorted from the blushing Major, who never told fibs, however they might be to his advantage, what was the real hour of the morning, he broke out into a volley of bad language, which we will not repeat here, but by which he gave Dobbin to understand that he would jeopardy his soul if he got up at that moment, that the Major might go and be hanged, that he would not travel with Dobbin, and that it was most unkind and ungentlemanlike to disturb a man out of his sleep in that way. On which the discomfited Major was obliged to retreat, leaving Joes to resume his interrupted slumbers. The chaise came up presently, and the Major would wait no longer. If he had been an English nobleman traveling on a pleasure tour, or a newspaper courier bearing dispatches, government messages are generally carried much more quietly, he could not have traveled more quickly. The postboys wondered at the fees he flung amongst them. How happy and green the country looked as the chaise whirled rapidly from milestone to milestone, through neat country towns, where landlords came out to welcome him with smiles and bows, by pretty roadside inns, where the signs hung on the elms, and horses and wagoners were drinking under the checkered shadow of the trees, by old halls and parks, rustic hamlets clustered round ancient grey churches, and through the charming friendly English landscape. Is there any in the world like it? To a traveler returning home it looks so kind it seems to shake hands with you as you pass through it. Well, Major Dobbin passed through all this from Southampton to London, and without noting much beyond the milestones along the road. You see, he was so eager to see his parents at Camberwell. He grudged the time lost between Piccadilly and his old haunt at the Slaughters, whither he drove faithfully. Long years had passed since he saw it last, since he and George, as young men, had enjoyed many a feast and held many a revel there. He had now passed into the stage of old fellowhood. His hair was grizzled, and many a passion and feeling of his youth had grown gray in that interval. There, however, stood the old waiter at the door, in the same greasy black suit, with the same double chin and flaccid face, with the same huge bunch of seals at his fob, rattling his money in his pockets as before, and receiving the Major, as if he had gone away only a week ago. "At the Major's things in 23, that's his room," John said, exhibiting not the least surprise. "Oast fowl for your dinner, I suppose. You ain't got married? They said you was married, the Scotch surgeon of yours was here." "No, it was Captain Hummy of the 33rd, as was quartered with the THNNG. Like any warm water? What do you come in a chay for? Ain't the coach good enough? And with this, the faithful waiter, who knew and remembered every officer who used the house, and with whom 10 years were but as yesterday, led the way up to Dobbin's old room, where stood the great moreen bed, and the shabby carpet, a thought more dingy, and all the old black furniture covered with faded chintz, just as the major recollected them in his youth. He remembered George pacing up and down the room, and biting his nails, and swearing that the governor must come round, and that if he didn't care a straw, on the day before he was married. He could fancy him walking in, banging the door of Dobbin's room, and his own hard by, "You ain't got young," John said, calmly surveying his friend of former days. Dobbin laughed. "N years and a fever don't make a man young, John," he said. "'Tis you that are always young, no, you are always old." "What became of Captain Osborne's widow?" John said. "I'm young fellow that. Lord, how he used to spend his money. He never came back after that day he was marched from here. He owes me £3 at this minute. Look here, I have it in my book. April 10, 1815, Captain Osborne. £3. I wonder whether his father would pay me," and so saying, John of the Slaughters pulled out the very morocco pocketbook in which he had noted his loan to the captain, upon a greasy faded page still extant, with many other scrawled memoranda regarding the bygone frequenters of the house. Having inducted his customer into the room, John retired with perfect calmness. And Major Dobbin, not without a blush and a grin at his own absurdity, chose out of his kit the very smartest and most becoming civil costume he possessed, and laughed at his own tanned face and gray hair, as he surveyed them in the dreary little toilet glass on the dressing table. "I'm glad old John didn't forget me," he thought. "S'she'll know me too, I hope." And he sallied out of the inn, bending his steps once more in the direction of Brompton. Every minute incident of his last meeting with Amelia was present to the constant man's mind as he walked towards her house. The arch and the Achilles statue were up since he had last been in Piccadilly. 100 changes had occurred which his eye and mind vaguely noted. He began to tremble as he walked up the lane from Brompton, that well-remembered lane leading to the street where she lived. Was she going to be married or not? If he were to meet her with the little boy, good God, what should he do? He saw a woman coming to him with a child of 5 years old. Was that she? He began to shake at the mere possibility. When he came up to the row of houses, at last, where she lived, and to the gate, he caught hold of it and paused. He might have heard the thumping of his own heart. "May God Almighty bless her, whatever has happened," he thought to himself. "Pshaw! She may be gone from here," he said and went in through the gate. The window of the parlor which he used to occupy was open, and there were no inmates in the room. The major thought he recognized the piano, though, with the picture over it, as it used to be in former days, and his perturbations were renewed. Mr. Clapp's brass plate was still on the door, at the knocker of which Dobbin performed a summons. A buxom-looking lass of 16, with bright eyes and purple cheeks, came to answer the knock and looked hard at the major as he leant back against the little porch. He was as pale as a ghost, and could hardly falter out the words, "Does Mrs. Osborne live here?" She looked him hard in the face for a moment, and then turning white too said, "Lord bless me, it's Major Dobbin." She held out both her hands, shaking, "Auntie, remember me?" she said. "Used to call you Major Sugar Plums." On which, and I believe it was for the first time that he ever so conducted himself in his life, the major took the girl in his arms and kissed her. She began to laugh and cry hysterically, and calling out, "Hey, Pa!" with all her voice, brought up those worthy people, who had already been surveying the major from the casement of the ornamental kitchen, and were astonished to find their daughter in the little passage in the embrace of a great tall man in a blue frock coat and white duck trousers. "I'm an old friend," he said, not without blushing though. "Auntie, remember me, Mrs. Clapp, and those good cakes you used to make for tea? Don't you recollect me, Clapp?" I'm George's godfather, and just come back from India. A great shaking of hands ensued. Mrs. Clapp was greatly affected and delighted. She called upon heaven to interpose a vast many times in that passage. The landlord and landlady of the house led the worthy major into the Sedley's room, whereof he remembered every single article of furniture, from the old brass-ornamented piano, once a natty little instrument, Stothard maker, to the screens and the alabaster miniature tombstone, in the midst of which ticked Mr. Sedley's gold watch. And there, as he sat down in the lodger's vacant armchair, the father, the mother, and the daughter, with a thousand ejaculatory breaks in the narrative, informed Major Dobbin of what we know already, but of particulars in Amelia's history of which he was not aware, namely of Mrs. Sedley's death, of George's reconcilement with his grandfather Osborne, of the way in which the widow took on at leaving him, and of other particulars of her life. Twice or thrice he was going to ask about the marriage question, but his heart failed him. He did not care to lay it bare to these people. Finally, he was informed that Mrs. O was gone to walk with her pa in Kensington Gardens, whither she always went with the old gentleman, who was very weak and peevish now, and led her a sad life, though she behaved to him like an angel, to be sure, of a fine afternoon, after dinner. I'm very much pressed for time, the major said, and have business tonight of importance. I should like to see Mrs. Osborne, though. Suppose Miss Polly would come with me, and show me the way? Miss Polly was charmed and astonished at this proposal. She knew the way. She would show Major Dobbin. As he had often been with Mr. Sedley, when Mrs. O was gone Russell Square way, and knew the bench, where he liked to sit. She bounced away to her apartment, and appeared presently in her best bonnet, and her mama's yellow shawl and large pebble brooch, of which she assumed the loan in order to make herself a worthy companion for the major. That officer then, in his blue frock coat and buckskin gloves, gave the young lady his arm, and they walked away very gaily. He was glad to have a friend at hand for the scene which he dreaded somehow. He asked a thousand more questions from his companion about Amelia. His kind heart grieved to think that she should have had to part with her son. How did she bear it? Did she see him often? Was Mr. Sedley pretty comfortable now in a worldly point of view? Polly answered all these questions of Major Sugarplums to the very best of her power. And in the midst of their walk an incident occurred which, though very simple in its nature, was productive of the greatest delight to Major Dobbin. A pale young man with feeble whiskers and a stiff white neckcloth came walking down the lane, and sandwich having a lady, that is, on each arm. One was a tall and commanding middle-aged female, with features and a complexion similar to those of the clergyman of the Church of England by whose side she marched, and the other a stunted little woman with a dark face, ornamented by a fine new bonnet and white ribbons, and in a smart pelisse, with a rich gold watch in the midst of her person. The gentleman, pinioned as he was by these two ladies, carried further a parasol, shawl, and basket, so that his arms were entirely engaged, and of course he was unable to touch his hat in acknowledgement of the curtsy with which Miss Mary Clapp greeted him. He merely bowed his head in reply to her salutation, which the two ladies returned with a patronizing air, and at the same time looking severely at the individual in the blue coat and bamboo cane who accompanied Miss Polly. "Who's that?" asked the major, amused by the group, and after he had made way for the three to pass up the lane. Mary looked at him rather roguishly. "That is our curate, the Reverend Mr. Binney," a twitch from Major Dobbin, "and his sister Miss B. Lord bless us, how she did use to word us at Sunday school. And the other lady, the little one with the cast in her eye and the handsome watch, is Mrs. Binney, Miss Gritz that was. Her pa was a grocer, and kept the little original gold teapot in Kensington gravel pits. They were married last month, and are just come back from Margate. She's £5,000 to her fortune, but her and Miss B, who made the match, have quarreled already. If the major had twitched before, he started now, and slapped the bamboo on the ground with an emphasis which made Miss Clapp cry, la, and laugh too. He stood for a moment, silent, with open mouth, looking after the retreating young couple, while Miss Mary told their history, but he did not hear beyond the announcement of the reverend gentleman's marriage. His head was swimming with felicity. After this rencounter he began to walk double quick towards the place of his destination, and yet they were too soon, for he was in a great tremor at the idea of a meeting for which he had been longing any time these 10 years, through the Brompton lanes, and entering at the little old portal in Kensington Garden Wall. There they are, said Miss Polly, and she felt him again start back on her arm. She was a confidant at once of the whole business. She knew the story as well as if he had read it in one of her favorite novel books, Fatherless Fanny, or The Scottish Chiefs. Suppose you were to run on and tell her, the major said. Polly ran forward, her yellow shawl streaming in the breeze. Old Sedley was seated on a bench, his handkerchief placed over his knees, prattling away, according to his wont, with some old story about old times to which Amelia had listened, and awarded a patient smile many a time before. She could of late think of her own affairs, and smile or make other marks of recognition of her father's stories, scarcely hearing a word of the old man's tales. As Mary came bouncing along, and Amelia caught sight of her, she started up from her bench. Her first thought was that something had happened to Georgie, but the sight of the messenger's eager and happy face dissipated that fear in the timorous mother's bosom. News! News! Cried the emissary of Major Dobbin. He's come! He's come! Who's come? Said Emmy, still thinking of her son. Look there, answered Miss Clapp, turning round and pointing. In which direction Amelia looking, saw Dobbin's lean figure and long shadow stalking across the grass. Amelia started in her turn, blushed up, and, of course, began to cry. At all this simple little creature's face, the grandzo were accustomed to play. He looked at her, oh, how fondly, as she came running towards him, her hands before her, ready to give them to him. She wasn't changed. She was a little pale, a little stouter in figure. Her eyes were the same, the kind, trustful eyes. There were scarce 3 lines of silver in her soft brown hair. She gave him both her hands as she looked up, flushing and smiling through her tears into his honest, homely face. He took the 2 little hands between his 2, and held them there. He was speechless for a moment. Why did he not take her in his arms, and swear that he would never leave her? She must have yielded. She could not, but have obeyed him. I have another arrival to announce, he said after a pause. Mrs. Dobbin? Amelia said, making a movement back. Why didn't he speak? No, he said, letting her hands go. Ho has told you those lies? I mean, your brother Joe's came in the same ship with me, and has come home, to make you all happy. Papa, Papa! Emmy cried out, here are news. My brother is in Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.